Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today with little corona content for a change. I'm sure it will recur next week. In moments, I'll talk with the journalist Lauren Sandler about homelessness in New York City during the boom years. God only knows what it's going to be like as the bust extends and deepens. And at the bottom of the hour, a critique of the new documentary Planet of the Humans, directed by Jeff Gibbs, a long-term collaborator with Michael Moore, who produced it and has been publicizing it and defending it as well. Before that, some audio from early February, just after the January employment report was released, featuring Trump's top economic advisor Larry Kudlow in conversation with Fox's Bill Hemmer. An important detail to know about Kudlow, he's almost always wrong. But here he is being spectacularly wrong about the health and economic effects of COVID-19. I'm playing this clip not just to embarrass Kudlow, who deserves lots of mockery, but as a reminder of just how badly wrong the top leadership of this country was about the pandemic.
Is the coronavirus the kind of thing that can suggest the end to this cycle? Do you see that as a possibility? Is there something else out there on the horizon that could bring the bulls back?
Well, look, the coronavirus is essentially a China problem. And we're doing everything we can to help them, by the way, offering advice, sending smart people over there and so forth. It's not a U.S. problem. The impact on the American economy will be very, very, very small, if any. I mean, actually, you've had 2 months of the virus, Bill, December, January. The January number, yes, that's correct. But I'm just saying what we know factually. The January numbers are coming in great, not just jobs, but ISM manufacturing and services, low unemployment claims, strong housing. We really haven't seen any economic impact. There may be some out there. Our own internal numbers say maybe 0.2% in the first quarter. But that's not going to end this growth cycle. If anything, I will give President Trump some credit here, please. His strong State of the Union message, his confidence, his optimism, and tax cuts and deregulation and energy and good trade deals, he has reinvigorated and restructured and rebuilt this economy. It's almost like we're starting a new recovery cycle, and that's why I think it's going to go on for several years.
Several years.
That was Larry Kudlow, chair of the National Economic Council, in conversation with Fox's Bill Hemmer just after the U.S. employment report for January was released on February 7th. That belongs in a hall of infamy. My first guest is Lauren Sandler. She's a Brooklyn-based journalist who's written for a long list of newspapers and magazines. Her third book, This Is All I Got, A New Mother's Search for Home, is just out from Random House. It's a look at a homeless single mother in New York City, someone who does everything right and still can't get out of the hole that our wretched society has dug for her. The bureaucratic hurdles are so multiple and so daunting that even the extremely sharp, organized, and well-informed protagonist of the book is beaten down by them. The book was written during the boom years, a boom that is now dead. We can only speculate on what will happen as more people enter poverty with an extremely porous and mean safety net. Sandler's book is a reminder that even in what were supposed to be good times, our economy was generating lots of misery. You'd almost think it was structural. Lauren Sandler, how did you come to write this book? What led up to it?
I felt an intense grief about homelessness. I felt almost in a physical way how unbearable it is to be a witness to a human rights crisis in our country that I feel people don't talk about enough and certainly don't feel viscerally beyond a sense of guilt and distancing. It used to be that we had a far more engaged and trenchant conversation about homelessness back when homelessness was not nearly the issue that it is now. And over time, and I have a lot of thoughts about why this is, that conversation eroded and our relationship to this catastrophe eroded. And living in New York as the luxury housing boom was really out of control and inequality was a constant ever-widening chasm between the people who live luxury New York and the people who live poverty New York. It was something that I was just feeling all the time. And as someone who writes about inequality, as someone who writes specifically about gender and inequality, I just felt like this was something that I needed to do. this is sort of what I had become a journalist to do in the first place. I was led into this field by books like There Are No Children Here, by later on by Adrienne LeBlanc's book, Random Family. Those were the books that I most venerated and was pulled to. And I really felt like that was the sort of book that I needed to attempt in some way, because after doing a lot of reporting on policy studies, on data, on sort of the larger issues that we face, I really felt like in order to feel this crisis, we had to live through it as readers. Random Family was reported over 20 years ago. It's a story of a different era, of a different New York, and frankly, of a different capitalism than the one we've been inhabiting. And so I wanted to find a community that would let me in. And I found a shelter in Brooklyn, in Park Slope, seen as, I think, the epicenter of artisanal motherhood and liberal preciousness. I wasn't looking for that contrast, but these things have a way of providing themselves. And so I found myself in this shelter, really working with a small group of women, four different women who consented to be part of this process.
This is a private shelter. It's not a public city shelter.
It is. So public city shelters absolutely will not permit journalists then. I worked really, really hard to try to get access to a city shelter. And this to me is a huge issue. Obviously, it's our tax dollars that pay for these shelters. And we know a lot of bad things happen in these shelters.
Yeah, they just don't want the public to see how terrible they are.
I think that there's that. I think that there's also, you know, there are very legitimate privacy issues for the people who live there. But yeah, I think that the concept that this is a taxpayer-funded institution that never gets any journalistic oversight is something that is a real issue. And I spent some time thinking about what it would mean to sue to get access, because I think that that's something that actually needs to happen. I think that if I was someone with a salary and an institution that had lawyers to back me up, et cetera, that is something that I would have chosen to do. And I do hope that that is something that major publications will choose to do. It's tough to do when you're on your own, but it's a major issue that we don't have access to city shelters. So I found a private shelter. I found a very small private shelter, which is run by just one or two people and a host of volunteers, and houses between 6 and 12 women, whether they're pregnant or have newborn babies, depending on what their vacancy rate is at the moment. I was told, yeah, come on in, do whatever you want. We want you to run our Wednesday night residence meeting. And other than you showing up to do that, that's your only requirement. You have full access. Anyone who wants to talk to you can talk to you. And so I had to be really careful about that, because was I working for the shelter but also reporting on it? Was there going to be an issue in terms of a power dynamic with anyone who might not want to be represented? Would there be concern about retribution for that? So I just started showing up, and for the first month I showed up without my notebook, just to really hang out and let people know that if they did not want to be reported on, they wouldn't be. And if they wanted to change their mind about that within the process, that would be fine. I wasn't there to try to expose anyone. And there were four women from different backgrounds who were interested in sharing their stories with me. But one of them really emerged as what the center of my story would be. And that was for a couple reasons. One was just that alchemy that happens between a journalist and who you're writing about, that notion of sort of choosing each other, that notion of wanting to connect and spend time together in that way, which is complicated but also magical. But also because she had very much emerged as the center of this story and then was evicted from the shelter. And so at that moment, I had to decide, okay, am I going to center this whole story in this space with these people, or am I going to follow her to her overcrowded apartment in the Bronx, through her search for affordable housing, through her search for shelter? And I chose in the end to really focus on her and her story.
She comes across as a very sharp person, really understands the system, tries to do everything right, and it's really impossible, of course. But just one blow after another, just one defeat after another, it's just heartbreaking to read how the system crushes her, despite the fact that she, you know, she could not be more equal to the task. Talk about her personality and how she fit into the system.
She's extraordinary. She's someone who sued her parents for child support when she was a teenager and won. She's someone who, after she was placed in foster care in Staten Island, she found the commute and the degree of abuse in her foster home to be so punishing that she figured out how to rent a room for herself in Manhattan so she could, you know, have a greater focus on her studies at her high school there. She's someone who would have gone to John Jay for criminal justice had she been able to find any housing in New York. So she is exceptional in many ways, but I will also say what she receives from the system, that level of draconian policy and impossibility, there's nothing exceptional about that. She is not someone who was simply dealt a bad hand, and this is a hard luck story from within our social services system. What I saw her experience is what I saw everyone else experience at the shelter. When she loses her public assistance case, I could have been talking about her. I could have been talking about any of the other women I knew, because it was a very similar experience.
Just the blank wall that you had, like, you're terminated with no real explanation, or, you know, okay, now you have to go to DeKalb now. You started in the Queens, and now you have to go to Brooklyn. It's just like one thing after another that's completely inexplicable. Even somebody with an army of lawyers would have a hard time navigating this system. But, you know, a poor person with no resources is just overwhelmed. You'd almost think it was deliberate.
Well, there are a lot of people who do think it's deliberate. You know, there's this concept of administrative burden, which has been put forth by a professor at Georgetown and a colleague of his, and I feel bad that I can't remember where she is. But, you know, it's this concept that there is intentionally unnavigatable social services, that policy is intentionally broken, that the paperwork is intentionally impossible, that the number of appointments, the location of the offices, everything just basically exists to keep as many people off the dole as possible. Because as Camilla, my protagonist, would tell you, it's not worth it. She would go through that constantly and say, this is not worth it. The amount of support that I get for the amount of time that I'm investing in trying to get it, ending up with nothing, it's not worth it. And so then the question is, if it's not worth it, but that's all you've got, what do you do? You know, she's someone who was a single mother with an infant who was trying desperately to stay in school as a criminal justice student and was not going to get a minimum wage job, which frankly couldn't get her housing either. So the question became, do I stay in school and have a work study job and be on welfare, which for her was such a source of shame. You know, her mother was on welfare. It was a cycle that she was insistent upon breaking. Even when she had her baby, she still said, I'm not going on welfare, until she had to, because there is no other tenable way to live.
Now, a parenthetical question. What is welfare now? There's no more AFDC. So is this TANF?
Yeah, exactly.
It's TANF, which is really, really cheap. I mean,
Yeah, it's like 16 grand a year.
And time limited, too, right?
Yeah, and a time limit, and you need to demonstrate that you are either working full-time or in school full-time or looking for work full-time, which this was not Camilla's story, but Irina, who's another character in the book, she's someone who, you know, had a law degree from Russia and spent her life dropping off her baby at a daycare center so that she could sit in a crammed waiting room for the possibility of a home healthcare job to pop up. And it was just days and days and days and days on and weeks of waiting for jobs that would never come through, just to prove that she was sitting in that room full time instead of raising her baby, instead of doing other work that she would want to be doing. It's maddening.
Yeah, and then Camilla gets cut off from daycare for what reason was it?
Oh, who knows, right?
So it's just like one day you're cut off.
So she had missed a letter that was sent to her post office box. Actually, she didn't miss it. It never arrived. And because that letter informing her of some obscure thing that she was supposed to do, some bit of paperwork, she didn't file that paperwork because she didn't know that she had to, and therefore she lost her public assistance case, and her child care was tied to her public assistance case, and it took weeks to figure out why actually she had lost this case. And during that whole time, it also meant that her daycare provider wasn't going to be paid. And her daycare provider was another poor woman who was living in an impossible situation in the Bronx. I mean, the domino effect is just, it's stunning, really.
I'm speaking with Lauren Sandler, author of This Is All I Got, A New Mother's Search for Home, just out from Random House. Let's step back in history here a bit, because I moved to New York in 1979, and there were homeless people, but it was not the homeless problem. It didn't really exist at that point. It didn't really become noticeable until this, in 1979. We're still coming out of the fiscal crisis. There's still a lot of shabbiness. The boom took off 82, 83, and that's when the homeless problem started. It was not a function of mass poverty that the city experienced during the 70s. It was when the boom really started taking off. I was in the Upper West Side. People were getting kicked out of SROs and moving to the Broadway median. And that's how I remember the development of homelessness in New York City. But it was a byproduct of a boom. It was not mass poverty. And here we are 40 years later. Well, obviously, the situation has changed radically over the last few months, but until then, the boom was displacing so many people. The side-by-side coexistence of extreme wealth and extreme poverty is just stunning to watch. And at the same time, the welfare state was cut back.
Yeah, exactly. Who could have imagined that? To me, that would sound like the good old days, right? Yeah, I moved to New York in 1992 when there were 22,000 homeless people, and we considered it a crisis. There was an average of 1 to 2 stories about homelessness in the New York Times every single day that year. And now it's over 70,000 homeless people in New York, and it's just a big shrug. And meanwhile, the glass towers that are rising up over the city, the $1.2 billion in tax breaks, it's basically a big developer buyout. It's absolutely shocking in the richest city of the richest country in the world, where we have more millionaires than anywhere else. It's a choice. This is a choice. It doesn't have to be this way. It isn't this way in other places. This is what we have chosen to be. And I was on a call with a guy who runs the a homeless outreach program in Seattle, who said something that I really wish I had thought of myself the other day. As he said, let's think about the outrage around price gouging for hand sanitizer and how that was seen to be such a crisis, such an abomination, that people would charge whatever people were willing to pay for hand sanitizer. We're not willing to think that about housing. That's exactly how the housing market has worked this whole time. It's the same price gouging, that housing goes to the highest possible bidder without even a thought. And that's just what we've accepted our world should be.
Well, yeah, the people's idea of what's a healthy housing market is when prices are rising. It's just remarkable that you think a healthy housing market is when one of life's essentials becomes progressively more expensive.
Sure. I think a lot about my grandfather, who moved to the Bronx in, I think, 1912, and lived right around the corner from the overcrowded apartment where Camilla ended up living for part of that year. They showed up with nothing and ended up being able to rent an apartment off Grand Concourse. My grandfather and his 3 siblings and his single father, and make a reasonable life for themselves because of housing costs. And I think about the life that I have gotten to have a century later because of what inequality looked like then versus now, which then it wasn't great either. But when I think about Camilla as my parents' generation in that immigration story, and when I think about her son as being my generation, and the degree of stability that I get to call my own compared to the fact that he's lived in 6 places and 2 shelters since he was born, and he's 4 now. She reminds me a lot of my grandfather, that sort of legal mind and that tenacity. And when I think about the different countries that we've inherited, it's stunning to me.
Well, also during that period was the era of social democratic New York, from the New Deal into the fiscal crisis period, when American welfare state was never very generous, but it was a little more generous here. There are a whole lot of public programs that made it easier for poor people. And that was all dismantled after the fiscal crisis. And then the boom came and people were just thrown out into the streets. How did Camilla understand how she got to the place where she is? Did she have any political analysis, or is it all personal stuff, or what?
I would not say that she's the most political-minded person. That just has not been part of of conversation that she's been exposed to. And it's that's not something that she has sought out on her own. And I think that there's an element to that, which is there's no time, right? I will say she's been a political science student. I mean, she's someone who can write a crack paper on Brown versus Board of Education. But in terms of thinking about capitalist structure, in terms of thinking about the oppression that she experiences and how that connects to policy, it's not how her mind has necessarily worked. Part of that is a coping mechanism. Part of that is a failure to politicize people who stand to gain most from reversing our worst policies. And I think that that's a larger crisis than simply how she perceives the world.
It seems like she had to do a lot of shutting people off, shutting people out. That seems to be one of her coping mechanisms. I imagine that's not unusual for someone in her situation. But yeah, what about that emotional, psychological relationship with others who often treat her very badly or betray or disappoint her?
When you are raised in a very dysfunctional family, there's a lot of dysfunction that comes out of that. It was only when a friend of mine, who's a school social worker, read the book in draft form that she said, oh, you are describing the psyche of pretty much every homeless kid I have ever worked with. I make real attempts to not psychologize her in the book because that is not either my relationship with her or my grounding as a journalist, but there's a real tendency for kids who are raised in poverty and certainly raised with a measure of abuse and poverty to either put people on a pedestal or have them be dead to you. That's certainly her tendency at times, to feel incredible connection, incredible affection, and incredible openness, and then need to protect herself against the possibility of being hurt and therefore exert control over a relationship. I mean, she and I have certainly been through this and have come out the other side, thankfully, a couple years ago. But it's a really difficult way to maintain relationships when you need to feel like you have to protect yourself all the time because that's what you've been taught. That's a tendency that is not just relegated to the poor, but the fewer resources that you have growing up, the harder it is to be okay.
The book's really a reminder of just how important it is to have a house, a roof of some sort. Without that, you just cannot do anything else in your life. Our social policy just doesn't really proceed from that basic fact.
I think that there are a couple of factors there. I think that our social policy is so siloed and that we rarely think of our social policy in terms of any sort of hierarchy of needs. And we also don't think about how one element of social policy leads to how the next element is lived out. And so we talk about welfare as though welfare is separate from housing. We talk about housing as though housing is separate from education. You know, we talk about all of these things as though they are not deeply interlocking, because that's not how we fund and govern and study. But it was one thing that really was the clearest thing that I took out of my time at the shelter, which I did not fully understand before at all, which was about how housing is simply the most foundational need, how without stable housing, nothing else is possible. And that doesn't mean that once stable housing exists, everything is an easy fix, but at least there becomes a door that can crack open towards possibility, so that if we can fix other things, that can help. But without giving people a place to live, life is simply impossible.
I think a lot of people look at, a lot of well-off people look at the homeless, the poor, and say, well, if you'd only done X or Y or Z right, then you wouldn't be in this situation. It's always your fault, of course. But Camila does everything right. You know, she tries so hard. She's going to school. She wants to do everything right. And still, the system is so stacked against her that she just can't get her nose above water.
Yeah, not to sound like the people who use the word rigged all the time, but it's rigged. rigged. I can't say it enough.
It's okay.
You know, it's an inheritance game. Our entire system is based on who you are born to and what wealth they have when you are born and what wealth they have when they die. And that is the full sum of it. We need to be able to understand that as a society, or nothing is going to change. The entire entire basis of our society is an inheritance game, full stop. And that is an exponential graph, right? That's the way this all works, is the people who have more get more because of that sort of investment. And the people who have less get less because of that sort of investment. And so that chasm just widens with every generation. And here we are having failed to account for it or even see it for the most part, I think, committing to these ideas of bootstraps that have never been true and are less true than ever before.
And finally, I mean, we can only speculate on this, but now we're in the midst of this vast health and economic crisis. Many, many people are going to be thrown into situations that, you know, they're completely unfamiliar with. From what you've reported, what you've researched, what's going to happen to this as everything comes crashing down?
This conversation is starting to feel like the narrative arc of this book, which is it's going to start depressing and then it's going to get so much worse.
Yeah.
I will tell you, having witnessed life in the safety net during unprecedented prosperity and seeing how overwhelmed and dysfunctional that system is in the best of times. We shredded that safety net in the best of times, and now it's the worst of times, and we are entirely screwed. The tiniest anecdote that just came to mind about Camilla needing to prove that a rent check was going to her shelter from the public assistance office and her having to show up at the public assistance office 5 times just to get proof that a single check went out. That is a dysfunctional system. And that's when those waiting rooms were not crowded in the same way. So now we suddenly have 22 million people who have lost their jobs in the past month. We have the unemployment hotline crashing. We have offices that can't even open because of social distancing. I mean, what it will mean to begin to reopen that element of the system, I cannot even imagine. And I don't see any evidence that in our bailout package, that's a system that's being bailed out, right? There's stimulus money, of course, going to Ruth's Chris Steakhouse in Delta, but the notion that we all of a sudden need to hire massive numbers of workers and train them, that we need to flood the system with money to save people's lives and to honestly do the best thing we can for our economy, that's where we need to invest right now. And that simply isn't happening. I think people have no idea what they're in for. And I think it's going to be very, very scary, especially considering the majority of this country that was already rent burdened. You know, we've all seen the figure about how people couldn't drop under $400 in savings to deal with, you know, to help get 3 months food and rent. These are very, very real numbers, and they were very real before all of this hit.
But the Treasury is setting up a special facility to help oil companies.
Yes, and I am really, really angry all the time, and I was really all the time before this, but it is as though this dystopia has no end, truly.
That was Lauren Sandler, author of This Is All I Got, A New Mother's Search for Home, just out from Random House. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. I was sent up to hell with poverty. No lyrics in that excerpt, just the great guitar work of Andy Gill, who died on February 1st, with some mighty drum backup by Hugo Burnham. Next, the climate crisis, specifically Planet of the Humans, a new documentary on the topic directed by Jeff Gibbs, a longtime associate of Michael Moore, who is executive producer of the film. It's a shabby piece of work that features grossly out-of-date information on solar and wind power, a totally exaggerated perspective on biomass energy, an inexcusable smear job on Bill McKibben, dark suggestions that population is the main problem, all presented with absolutely no political analysis or strategy. Considering all the good work Moore and Gibbs have done over the years, it's massively disappointing and very poorly timed. I came across an excellent critique of the documentary posted to Facebook and later to Medium by Kathy Cowan Becker, an environmental activist based in Ohio. Here she is with a radio version. Kathy Cowan Becker. You're a Michael Moore fan who is disappointed by this his participation in this film project, right?
Yes, so I've been following Michael Moore since Roger and Me. I was in graduate school at that time and watched Fahrenheit 9/11 and 11/9, and I was a Bernie supporter, and Michael Moore was a surrogate of Bernie's, and I thought made very astute observations of the Democratic primary and the election in general. And I actually went to a campaign for Bernie in Iowa and went to a Michael Moore event there and met him. I mean, I can't claim to know him or anything, but I got a selfie with him. And so I was really surprised when this film came out.
Okay, there are several dimensions to its problems, so let's take them one at a time. Basically, the message seems to be that renewables are a sham and the environmental movement is hopelessly corrupted by big capital. That's pretty much what they're trying to say there, right?
Yeah, that seems to be the main point of the film, and that environmental groups have been taken over by big capital and that they aren't considering the true solutions to the climate crisis, and that this film doesn't think renewables are any of the, it doesn't seem like they think it's any of the solution.
To be clear, there are some serious problems with mainstream environmentalism, and they do get kind of close to big business, and, you know, Michael Bloomberg is a problematic figure all over the thing. So, like, let's just make that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Bill McKibben doesn't seem like one of the bad guys.
No, I don't think so. And in fact, last year, Bill McKibben spoke to an audience at Ohio State University in an event that I arranged that I'm just a regular grassroots activist. And I wrote him an email and said, would you speak to us about climate change in the 2020 election? This was leading up to the debate in Westerville, Ohio. I never thought he would answer, but he did. And he gave us an hour of his time for free. In the emails I had with him, I kept asking, can we send you an honorarium? You know, what kind of honorarium? And he just ignored those questions. So he spoke for free to us.
The film flirts with the idea of overpopulation, or pretty much that's a big part of the problem, but they're kind of silent on what to do about it, right?
Yeah, they don't really talk at all about what to do about overpopulation, and there's that's not a straightforward issue because the countries that have the highest birth rates are among the lowest in carbon emissions. Those are the poorest countries. Those are not where people have a high carbon footprint, whereas in the rich countries, such as the United States, people have a very high carbon footprint, but not as high of a birth rate. And if you start saying, okay, where do you deal with the overpopulation situation? China had its one-child policy that resulted in a lot of infanticide of baby girls. And today has a glut in boys that were born. There's a glut of bachelors there. And then there's the eco-fascism movement that doesn't want people from, basically does not want black and brown people to reproduce. How do we not get into telling people who can and cannot reproduce? That's just not somewhere we should want to go. But the book Drawdown, which is a major work about the climate crisis and how to address it and looks at the 100 top solutions and is very wide ranging in its look at solutions. The second top solution is education of girls and family planning, basically reproductive health and freedom, and education and empowerment of girls and women. And this would be the second highest source of reductions of carbon emissions. According to Drawdown, this was a group of researchers and scientists who actually put measurements to all of their solutions. And that's what a lot of scientists and researchers, people who've actually been looking at the problem, you know, basically come down to is we need empowerment of women, which you wouldn't think necessarily would be related to carbon emissions, but it is. But this movie doesn't even touch any of that. If it claims to be a movie about the climate crisis, but hasn't even looked at drawdown, that's not doing your due diligence.
The talking heads are dominated by white men.
Yes, that is very true. And that tells you a lot right there.
Yeah. And when you talk about overpopulation and you don't really say how you're going to do something about it, it does make you wonder what they have up their sleeves.
Right. And a lot of people have said this movie is a gateway to ecofascism, which, you know, if you don't lay out, you know, a direction to go with this, then it could lead to that.
Now, it also has some very serious factual problems, particularly the attacks on renewable energy. And the heavy focus on biomass, which is actually a pretty small for, I think, what, about 2% of ours or something like that?
Right, yeah, that's according to the IEA, International, I believe it's Energy Administration.
Yeah.
Energy Agency. But they're kind of considered the go-to for measuring emissions and energy use and energy mix and things like that. And according to them, biomass is 2% in the United States. And what the film brings up about biomass is troubling and does deserve serious treatment and a serious audience. But they don't mention that it's such a small amount of our energy use in the United States. Although there is export of forests, forests in the Carolinas and in the Southeast are being chopped down and turned into wood chips and exported to Europe. So there is some of that. So if there had been an even-handed treatment of biomass, then certainly that would have been worth bringing up, but not with the misinformation that it peddles about renewable energy.
Yeah, that's the other problem. They visit that solar field in Michigan, right, that has a 8% efficiency rating. The thing is, what, 10, 12 years old, right? I mean, they're talking about completely obsolete conceptions of solar power.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was a science writer named Keaton Joshi who wrote a blog about this and pointed out how outdated a lot of the information is. So I linked to his piece where I talked about that as well. But this solar field in Michigan, they said, was 8% efficient and could maybe run 10 homes. But a solar field built now would have 8 to 10 times as much energy that would be produced. And also the price of solar has come way down, even in the last 12 years. Since the 70s, it's literally come down like 99% from what it was in the 1970s. But it's even come down from 2008.
Yeah, well, they rely on this guy, Ozzy Zehner, whose book is, what, like 10 years old? So
yeah, and his book is Anti-Renewable Energy as well, and that's their main expert, if you will. He gets a lot of FaceTime and interview time in the film, and he has one very particular point of view, and they don't talk to any of the many scientists and researchers whose work has found otherwise.
And wind energy, too. They seem to have a thing about that.
Yes, they showed an old wind field in Hawaii that Keaton Joshi had pointed out that was removed in 2012. And they showed, so the pictures they showed were pre-2012. It's now on Google Maps. You can look it up. It's a farm. I think it's a ranch with some livestock. And then the small concrete pads that these wind turbines stood on, but they're no longer there. So about both solar and wind, they basically argue that you have to mine materials to create those products, which is true, but there is a whole science, a whole field of research called life cycle analysis, abbreviated LCA, that has looked at renewable energy versus fossil fuels, like oil and coal, and found that over the life cycle, renewable energy releases and has much less of a destructive impact and releases far fewer greenhouse gases than fossil fuels. Like, this has been shown in many articles and research projects, and they didn't talk about that at all.
Yeah, and it requires that up front at the beginning. It requires fossil fuels and heavy industrial processes, but then these things last for a long time.
Right, exactly.
Don't need anymore.
That's another sort of argument, which is straight out of the climate denial handbook, that, oh, well, you had to use fossil fuels to make this, so therefore it's useless, or it's just as bad as fossil fuels, and that's just not true. Once you make a wind turbine or a solar panel, it runs from the sun or the wind for years, for decades. This film says 10 years for a solar panel, which just isn't true. 20 years, I think 25 years is what most of them are guaranteed for many of them last longer. But during that time, they are not having to be fed with energy sources that are continually mined, fracked, or drilled the way a combustion car has to be, a coal-fired plant has to be, a gas-fired plant has to be. Even a nuclear plant requires continuous fueling of uranium. And so that's why those products are not considered renewable, because they require continually mining to create, to find the materials to make this power, whereas a wind turbine or a solar panel, once it's built, that's it. And much of it can be recycled. So, for example, a battery in a car, there's work to recycle those to be home batteries, so that if you have solar panels on your home but you want to store some of that energy, you have a home battery, and some of those can be old car batteries. So there are ways to recycle these materials as well.
Yeah, well, they seem to rely on that old Sarah Palin line, that what you're going to do when the wind don't blow and the sun don't shine.
Yeah, they talk about that as well. And that's ignoring, for example, the research of Mark Jacobson. He has a lot of research projects, and then there are other research groups that have been inspired by him looking at how to transition to 100% renewable energy. And so one of his arguments is that if we upgrade the grid and we connect most of the grid, a lot of the grid in the United States is not connected to each other, so we do need an upgrade of the grid. But if we're starting to put a massive amount of solar and wind energy onto the grid, then say it's not shining right where you are, the sun isn't shining right where you are, well, it is somewhere, probably somewhere fairly close, and that power is going onto the grid. And so eventually, with enough critical mass of renewable energy onto the grid, that can overcome the problem of intermittency. And so none of that is discussed either.
I'm speaking with Kathy Cowan-Becker, an environmental activist in Ohio, and author of a critique of the Jeff Gibbs-Michael Moore documentary, Planet of the Humans. It's really hard to see what they want or how to get there. I mean, it just seems like a lot of preaching, tearing down of icons, I don't really see any kind of political path that they're presenting. Do you?
Right. No, I don't really either. It seems to be kind of a gotcha for the environmental movement. Like, you know, how you can make a movie about climate change and not talk about the decades-long climate denial, multi-billion-dollar industry funded by the oil companies and the coal companies and the utilities? How do you not talk about that when you talk about our inaction on climate change?
It's funny, you know, speaking of obsolete information, they still have David Koch as being alive in one scene.
Yeah, right, yeah, that's a good point.
But I think it seems like a lot of the film was made years ago. The launch of that Chevy Volt was many, many years ago, right?
I think that footage was from 2010.
Yeah.
And actually, I drive a Chevy Bolt, a similar electric vehicle. And they claim that, okay, if there's coal in the energy mix that you use to power that car, that it's just as bad as fossil fuels. But the research shows that's just not true. You can convert the electric vehicle to a miles per gallon equivalent. And depending on how clean the grid is where you are, it might be more miles per gallon. For example, in California, it's the equivalent of over 100 miles per gallon. And in Ohio, we have a pretty dirty grid. It's the equivalent of 56 miles per gallon. But that's still way better than most gas cars that are on the road in Ohio. And furthermore, efforts to clean up the grid continue. So we've had one city in Ohio, Cincinnati, that's building out the largest municipal solar array in the country. That energy will go onto the grid and start cleaning up the grid in Ohio. We have dozens of solar projects in Ohio that have been proposed, and many are being approved and being built. The city of Columbus has just committed to aggregation for 100% renewable energy by 2022. And so that, with having that buying power from a major city of almost a million people, we are pushing them to leverage that into building out a source of local solar here. That would go on the grid. You can clean up the grid. Like, obviously, it takes time, which is why we should have started this decades ago instead of delaying, which was a lot the result of this decades-long industry of climate denial, buying many of our politicians and successfully delaying this. It would have been much better if we had started earlier. But let's start now. Let's start cleaning this up now.
That's a point that I don't really take on either, that we don't need a technological revolution to substantially clean things up. We have the technologies now if we just use them.
Right, absolutely. You know, we have solar, we have wind. We just need the political will and leadership to use them, and we are starting to get that on the local level. There's 162 cities now committed to 100% renewable energy in one form or another. Eight states, 13 counties, D.C. and Puerto Rico. So this is continuing, and we will continue to build on that. We will continue to remain involved to see that these plans actually get carried out. And I guess another thing I want to address is one of the arguments of this movie seems to be that environmentalists just put all their faith in technology, like it's just a techno fix. And that just isn't true either in the environmental movement I know. We talk about population all the time. That's why it's in the book Drawdown. We talk about the need to consume less. And so in my campaigns about 100% renewable energy, the first step is energy efficiency, especially in buildings and cities. That's responsible for most of the emissions in cities is energy wasted in buildings. And cities themselves are responsible for 70% of carbon emissions in the world. So energy efficiency in buildings actually makes a really big difference, but also redesigning cities so that you build from the infill, you don't do sprawl, so that public transportation is much easier. You have safe bike paths, safe sidewalks so people can walk and bike. Like, it's a whole range and umbrella of policies to make this transition. And I don't know any environmentalist who thinks, oh, you just pop on a solar panel and you're great. Solar panels are part of the solution. This movie has misinformation about solar and wind, but they're not the only part of the solution. They are a piece.
Yeah, any serious environmentalist you talk to is going to talk about reconfiguring the way we live, how we grow food, how we distribute things. I mean, it's a comprehensive remake of the world we live in. It's not just a technical fix. So it's maybe that's what Michael Bloomberg thinks, but not any serious environmentalist.
Right. Nobody I know thinks that. And that's also true of the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal is not legislation. It's a whole series of legislation.
That didn't get a mention at all.
Yeah, that's true. It didn't. So that also goes to how dated this film is. And Michael Moore did say in an interview with Stephen Colbert that they had been working on this project for years. And I think my understanding is that most of the footage is from between 2010 and 2015, and it sat on the shelf for a long time. And I guess I'm wondering, why did they put this out now when we have, as Leah Stokes pointed out in her article, it's just an insult to the youth climate activists we have. And that whole youth climate movement has emerged in the past couple of years, well after most of this film was put together. Why now?
Yeah, I noticed that among the right-wing approval of the movie, it's funny to see Breitbart and the Competitive Enterprise Institute, these people applauding it, but one of the conservative reviewers took him to task for not making fun of Greta Thunberg.
Yeah, it's probably too dated for Greta Thunberg, to be honest.
Yeah, but I think underlying a lot of this kind of thinking is a critique of anything. They call it industrial civilization. And what do they want? Do they all just want us all to become hunter-gatherers again and live in caves? I mean, it's not really clear what the alternative to this industrial civilization is.
Yeah, no alternatives are explored in this film. So actually, that was kind of another thing I talked about in my piece, although there are many people who know much more about this than me, but there are economists who have looked at different ways of measuring our economy. Don't just look at gross domestic product and try to keep it growing at all costs. Look at the health of the people, the longevity, even happiness quotients, the health of the environment. There are many other measurements. Jeffrey Sachs is well known for talking about this, but so are many other economists. And that's something, if this was a question the film truly had and truly wanted to explore, the material is out there, but they didn't get into any of that.
Well, what's your sense of how it's being received? I've seen a lot of criticism of it, a lot of praise coming from right-wing sources, but is it going to have much of an impact, or has it been too discredited coming out of the gate?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I don't fully know the answer. As you say, a lot of the climate denial outlets that are funded by the fossil fuel industry and have been around for decades are basically rubbing their hands in glee over this and really touting it. A lot of, actual climate scientists and researchers and environmentalists are criticizing it much the way I did. But then there are some even on the left who are taking what this film says to heart and kind of saying the same thing, but not really providing any solutions either the way this film does it. So I have seen, I guess, quite a bit of people who are taking this film seriously and people who would have been supporting the Green New Deal, and that makes me really sad.
Yeah, the Green New Deal needs some promoters and fans right now with Bernie out of the race, This movie is not helping.
No, it's come along at a really bad time for that. And you know, the Green New Deal, that's not just a bunch of solar panels and wind turbines, although that's part of it. Some of the programs included there are a civilian climate conservation corps to take care of our wetlands or clean up toxic waste areas, replacing lead pipes in many of our cities that have high lead levels. Having a sustainable food system, so like rewarding farmers for practices like cover crops or regenerative agriculture, energy efficiency, which retrofitting buildings would create millions of jobs. And the Green New Deal itself is more or less a jobs program. And if there's anything we could use right now in the age of coronavirus when 25 million people are filing for unemployment, it's a major jobs program.
That was Kathy Cowan-Becker, an environmental activist based in Ohio. You can find her critique of Planet of the Humans at Medium.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of Ape Man by the Kinks. Till next week, bye.
I'm sophisticated because I'm living my life like a good homo sapiens. But all around me, everybody's multiplying and they're walking around like firemen. So I'm no better than the animals sitting in their cages in the zoo, man. Cause compared to the flowers and the birds and the trees, I am an ape man. I think I'm so educated and I'm so civilized because I'm a straight vegetarian. But with the overpopulation and inflation and starvation and the crazy politicians, I don't feel